And in every culture that with there was a rite of passage, it was something that involved a direct challenge to the boy for a couple reasons. One, to show him what he was made of. And we're going to talk about the virtues in a second, strength being the first one, right? Modern consumerist society has all these people, all these men surging with testosterone, but with no outlet, right? There's nothing that he needs. There's very few functions that are readily available to the boy who's surging with testosterone and has all the impulses that go with that, right? So if he doesn't go into video games, if he doesn't jerk off to porn all day, what does he do? He has all this aggression, and that comes out in weird ways because he's never grounded himself in emotional security or recognizing his the actual function of these impulses. When two guys can make fun of each other and they both can laugh, they're basically mutually submitting and saying, I'm willing to suffer for you, right? Like, obviously a joke at your expense isn't really suffering, but there is like an ego check, right? When a guy makes a joke about someone else, he's like reminding him, hey, you're not high and mighty. Like, I'm not putting you ahead of me. You better not put yourself ahead, because if you don't take this joke well, it shows that you think you're better than us, and that's not cool.
The Rwando Podcast is an exploration of the unconscious and the game of life. Be sure to visit Rwando.com to get a preview chapter of my upcoming book, Infinite Play, and free access to my content library. Enjoy the show.
Hey, what's up, folks? Good morning here from Thailand. Today we're going to speak about tribal virtues. I'm working off of last week's episode on the warrior archetype. I tried to save everything that has to do with male-to-male connection, bonding, interaction for this episode. Last week, if you didn't catch it, spoke about the warrior archetype from an individual level, from an internal perspective. But there's a lot to say about man-to-man bonding. The book Iron John talks about this, has spurred different branches of thought when it comes to masculine development that I agree with and disagree with. Today's episode was largely inspired by Jack Donovan's The Way of Men. I'm not going to speak about his book too directly because we're going to hopefully have him on the podcast soon. In the next weeks or so. So I'm going to save topics within his book for then. But it did inspire me to speak about the warrior archetype from a group level, because in many other episodes we've spoken about dominance hierarchies. And, you know, whether I've directly said it or not, a lot of the times what people think of is men in a group competing against each other. And that is something that happens typically. It's a natural instinct to compete against other men. But there's also an aspect of male bonding, and I'm calling this episode, I don't know if I will necessarily, but steel sharpening steel is a concept that I like, because there's certain aspects of a man's development and character that can only come out in all male groups. As you, I'm sure, have noticed, if you are a guy, when there's only guys around, guys act differently. And so we're going to speak about the virtues that can only be developed around other men. We're going to speak about male-to-male interaction from a cooperative perspective, which is not actually that different from the competitive, but obviously putting a more constructive spin on things. We'll speak about rites of passage. And last year, I wrote a post in the Masculine Underground group about how to start men's groups, especially during COVID now, with a lot of people starving for social connection. I've been recommending this even more to other guys about starting their own men's group or starting some sort of all-male social something. So I'm going to share my thoughts on that and what I find to be effective, because I have a lot of criticisms to things that are called men's groups. It might just be the hippie social situations I find myself in, but they're like particularly unmasculine. That's a loud airplane. Okay. So I'm going to speak about that. Yeah. And if you haven't catched this live, I know this is the last minute thing in the Masculine Underground group, feel free to comment, ask your questions. But if you are listening to the recording or watching the recording on YouTube, on Facebook, or wherever recordings are, it's going to be my public service announcement for every episode forever. I highly suggest that you get off your screen, download the podcast version of this. The content's exactly the same. It's not like I have visuals up. So you can listen to this episode while going for a walk, while doing some exercise, while doing something with your hands, as opposed to sitting and looking at your phone or your computer. Other quick announcements. Later this week, on Thursday, we have a great episode coming out with the BJJ Globetrotter, Christian Graugart. Christian has a company or community of people who travel the world doing jiu-jitsu. And other than just liking travel and jujitsu, I really appreciate his kind of Taoist philosophy, bringing certain warrior nature to like a Zen-like perspective. So he's a real cool guy. That episode comes out on Thursday. Next week, I'm going to talk about the lover archetype. I wasn't really planning on going through Moore and Gillette's King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, but I felt called to speak about the king archetype and the father nature a few months ago, and then last week was the warrior. Might as well go into the lover and magician at some point. So we're going to speak about that next week. And actually, this episode's kind of a gap bridge between the individualist, selfish, and not necessarily a bad way, but self-driven, go out into the world and seek adventure part of male nature, which is the warrior archetype, and the lover archetype, which is connecting with the feminine, whether internally or externally. This is kind of a bridge because before you can really be complete in the world of being a lover, I won't say before, but it's to be a complete, fully expressed, individuated man, you do need to access both your masculine and feminine side. The lover, the feminine side, we're going to save for next week, but there's more to say on this. So we'll start off with a quote from one of my favorite films that I reference all the time. I mean, it's really, when it comes to male mythologies, Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Fight Club, said this. I mean, there's only a couple things for men to look at. Like, women have tons of mythologies in contemporary fiction, right? They have the traveling sisterhood yaya pants thing, and like there's like something that always comes out, Joy Luck Club, whatever. There's only a few things for men. There's Fight Club, and I'm actually blanking on the other thing that Chuck mentioned, but there's really not a lot of male mythologies. Actually, my book, which will come out eventually, I'm hoping can fill in that gap, especially for our generation. But from Fight Club, Tyler Durden says, while he's in the bathtub, "We're a generation of men raised by women, and I'm wondering if another woman is really what we need." Fight Club hits on so many themes of the modern generation of men so acutely with like its analysis of consumerism and a lot of things. I'm not going to retell all of Fight Club, but this line kind of represents what also the book Iron John, which kind of spurred the men's rights movement in some ways, speaks about, which is recent generations of men, I'd say specifically from the advent of second wave feminism, certainly young men who were boys during the rise of third wave feminism, have created this like kind of attachment to the feminine. And you see a lot of guys who grew up who are basically afraid of their own masculinity. I think this is truer now more than ever. I mean, it's barely an opinion of mine. It's like pretty close to fact. And because of that, there's like new kinds of insecurities, whereas like historically, maybe men were too masculine in some ways, or some guys were like, destructively expressing their masculine edge. And you could look at all the things that come from masculinity that are negative. We spoke about some of those in the warrior archetype. Like obviously violence is a masculine expression. It's not always a good thing. In fact, most of the time violence is probably not a good thing. But then nowadays, there's a lot of guys who are afraid of their edge, and there's certain certain virtues that guys can only access around other men. As society has muted masculinity, a lot of boys are kind of attached to women. You see, like I spoke about this more in the Mother Complex episode, but so many adult guys have this like unhealthy attachment to either their literal mother or their concept of mother, and you can see this when guys turn their girlfriends into like a mother person. Like I hear this from my female friends all the time, like, my boyfriend treats me like his mother. And like part of that is on the woman, right? A part of it, I think, I won't get onto a whole rant on feminism, but part of it is that, in a situation where a girlfriend feels like the mother of her boyfriend, of course, there's some aspect of her acting like a mother, right? It's like kind of misplaced nurturing. But at the same time, if that dynamic exists, if you're in that dynamic, you have to recognize, where am I acting like a child? Where am I relying on the woman I'm sleeping with for emotional support, or things that I should and can either give myself or get from other men, or get out in the world where I don't have to have this interaction with the feminine, whether it's in mother or a girlfriend form, in a way that I'm using that to fill in the gaps in my self-esteem. The warrior archetype is the phase of development in the male psyche that should start during adolescence, like when our balls drop and testosterone starts surging through our bodies. All of the impulses that teenage boys have to like to do hard things, to be competitive, to go and explore the world. A lot of these impulses are kind of channeled into video games because that's what's available to most guys, or porn and video games, basically. But that those impulses are pure. Those impulses are your. We've evolved for thousands of generations to have those impulses, to send us on journeys, to do risky things that maybe will end up killing us. But if they don't, it'll give us the true emotional security to then be a leader, be a father, be a lover, be whatever. I talked about that last week, so I'm not going to repeat that. But this is a loss of natural virtue. And even though there is an independent aspect of the warrior archetype, especially when the boy actually becomes a man and picks up the sword or the axe or the hammer and goes out into the wild and does that, there is a transitional phase where the preteen or the young adolescent is taken from his family. I spoke about this. I'll just run through this. So the traditional rites of passage, and this is described in Iron John, which is a famous book if you haven't heard from it. Actually, someone just mentioning in the comments, Robert Bly referred to invisible substances, that invisible substance gets transmitted between men as we gather and get real, between men and boys. I mean, there's a mystical lens that is in our bone marrow. I'm not familiar with that. So when in traditional, essentially pre-agricultural societies from which we've all come ancestrally, when most children, I mean, children are prior to puberty, they're basically, you can treat them as asexual. They're just kids. They spend their time in the land of women. They get all their nurturing from women. If you're a boy prior to puberty, I mean, he's not that different from a girl in terms of his relationship to men and women. Like, he's just a kid, right? In the land of women, traditionally, back when biology necessitated our gender roles, or rather the other way around, boys were around women. They got their nurturing from there. They were dependent on their mothers. Prior to puberty, or around the time of puberty, they got abducted essentially by men. Obviously, the traditions in different cultures were a little different, but they were taken from the world of women into the world of men and put through some hardship. That was the rite of passage. And in every culture there was a rite of passage, it was something that involved a direct challenge to the boy for a couple reasons. One, to show him what he was made of. And we're going to talk about the virtues in a second, strength being the first one, right? He needs to know that he has the ability to take on shit, whether it's nature, whether it's killing an animal, whether it's challenge with other men. I mean, there's different Native American, the Native American vision quest, obviously there's many different versions of that. Putting him out into nature without food, without water, maybe attached to a tree or piercing through his body, something that puts him through pain where he has to dig deep and recognize that he has some abilities that maybe he didn't realize he had when he was a boy. The second piece of that is kind of like if you caught the episode on social constructions of reality, there's a negative aspect to it. But traditionally, a young human who's surging with testosterone and he has muscles for the first time, he has aggression for the first time, if he's not aligned with the collective, he can do some bad stuff. And this is kind of like, I mean, I hate the term toxic masculinity, but this is where this comes from, right? Modern consumer society has all these people, all these men surging with testosterone, but with no outlet, right? There's nothing that he needs. There's very few functions that are readily available to the boy who's surging with testosterone and has all the impulses that go with that, right? So if he doesn't go into video games, if he doesn't jerk off to porn all day, what does he do? He has all this aggression, and that comes out in weird ways because he's never grounded himself in emotional security or recognizing his the actual function of these impulses. So anyway, the young man, now recognizing his strength, has to go through a hardship, usually something that is humiliating or humbling. I mean, humbling and humiliating literally mean the same thing, even though they have different connotations, because then the boy recognizes, okay, I have this immense strength, but I'm still powerless. I mean, powerless in a sense without my collective. Like, there's a reason why I need to commit myself to the tribe. So the boy comes back from the rite of passage as a man, and he recognizes, okay, I'm really powerful, but my best use of this power, the most fulfilling expression of this power, is to do things that benefit my society, which back then was usually a tribe of 50 to 150 people. A lot of things kind of break down in our modern tribes that are hundreds of millions of people because we can't handle that many relationships. Dunbar's number. So I want to peel back for a second. I got excited and I jumped ahead. So I do want to speak about, first I want to speak about the, I'll continue on this with the origins of why these are specific to men. I do want to speak about masculine virtues. This is somewhat referencing Jack Donovan's book. I really like the way he laid it out. And then third, I'm going to end with my take on how men's groups should be formed, because I'm very frustrated with a lot of things that are called men's groups. I want to speak a little bit about my own experience with this, because if you've listened to this podcast, you know that like I grew up with a lot of insecurity around my masculinity, mainly because I was really shy and I just thought, you know, that made me less of a man or less useful as a person. And I did a lot of hyper masculine things growing up, like, and naturally I think I was drawn to that. It wasn't like I was always, it's not like I got into boxing, wrestling just to prove myself, although there was an aspect to that. I had this impulse, maybe driven by my insecurity, or because in regular social situations I just felt like I couldn't keep up with people who are louder or more confident or had more bravado. But I've always been into like fighting for some reason. Like that's always been like an interest of mine, whether it's like military battle tactics or combat sports or whatever. But like a lot of things were driven by my insecurity, and a lot of times I would throw myself into these hyper masculine environments, whether like rugby teams or like the Marines. I went through officer candidate school, and I always felt even worse. Like I felt like I didn't know how to interact with guys who were really potent or really strong. And part of my journey has been connecting with my feminine side, I think. And I'll save that till next week on the lover archetype. But a lot of me developing real grounded confidence came from also recognizing that I had certain unexpressed aspects to my oxytocin-driven side. But to be honest, I still felt like this insecurity. And like to admit, for a while after I became really competent and confident in connecting with women, for a while, I mean, in my mid-20s or so, I spent almost all of my time around women. Why? Because I just felt that, okay, I can really empathize. Girls really like me. Obviously, sexual validation is a huge boost to the ego and all that stuff. And then I would always feel a little uncomfortable around really masculine guys, because it exposed to me something. Exposed to me that there were areas that I wasn't adequate, right? With women, I felt super adequate. With around men, I was like, I don't feel so great. But even that started to nag me, because it's like maybe 3 years ago now, I started traveling Asia. I spent a bunch of time in Bali, and it's I just want to speak about this a little bit. So Ubud, Bali is an interesting place. It's where the book and movie Eat, Pray, Love takes part, or at least the love part of Eat, Pray, Love takes place. So a lot of people, since that book has come out, have moved to Bali to find themselves, especially women, older divorced women, younger college age women, and everything in between, go there to like find themselves and do yoga and eat vegan food. So I showed up there for the first time in early 2018, and I was shocked. I mean, there's like, it's like a 5-to-1 woman to man ratio. It's like something crazy like that. And a lot of the guys there are gay, because I mean, it's like a very feminine environment. It's like vegan, hippie, yoga everywhere. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Because like, not only are there a ton of women and very few men, very little competition, right? All the women are doing yoga all the time. They're super healthy and they're super thirsty, right? It's the only place in the world I've been to where I'll walk into a cafe, not dressed like anything in particular, and then all the women stare at you. And like, it's nothing special about me. Like a lot of guys have this experience when they walk into like, because there's so many women and so few men. And over there in an environment like that, the bar for masculinity is so low, right? Like if you can just make eye contact and keep your back straight and like keep your wrists straight, like you're already more masculine than a lot of guys there. And I don't say that, well, whatever, I say that the way I say it. So at first I was like, I can't believe this is like such a great kept secret. Like I don't want to tell anyone, because like all these bros are going to come here and like, you know, it's going to ruin the ratio. And I was wondering, like, how is it that there's so many women here, so many attractive women here, so many like eager women here, and like it's not flooded with guys, right? Because like anywhere else I've been, like New York or anywhere else, like if there's a place with a lot of attractive women, a lot of men show up, right? Naturally. But then I realized after a few months that it's because the environment was so feminine that if you're a masculine person, you just feel uncomfortable. Like there's something that doesn't feel right. Because I was there for a couple months and it was amazing. And then I started to feel like, I feel like I'm losing a part of myself. Like a part of me is atrophying. Like I end up growing my hair long, which I mind, but like I started like acting a little bit more feminine than I felt was good. And I just like, I had to be around some guys. So I became like obsessive about weightlifting during this time. Like there's something, it was just like, I felt like I was being sucked up into a void of yin, and it was like draining what was authentic in me. So I think that's why it's funny, like in this hyper feminine environment, it's kind of protected itself from masculinity, because like anyone who's masculine just doesn't feel good being there. I referenced that in my cult episode too. Even if you're a guy who seeks the feminine because you feel more secure, there's something that's lost. There's something that's missing. I know a lot of guys who are like great with women. Maybe they like did a lot of pickup stuff or whatever, and like they can really take advantage of attachment theory by acting avoidant and getting anxious women to like them, and like becomes a very easy thing. But they still are shy away from men, and they always have that insecurity, and it usually shows up in like their purpose and their ability to follow through on things and commitment. And that's and then anyway, this is important. I just want to tell one more story, because I. This is true even down to the instinctual level, because I think, you know, when we speak about masculinity, a lot of people are like, oh, well, your ideas, your constructs, blah, 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 culture. I'll say one more thing. So one of my like really close friends, a female friend, childhood friend, she has a nephew. Oh, she had, I mean, this nephew's probably, I don't know. But at this time, this was maybe a few years ago, it was like a 2-year-old boy. Her cousin was raising it, single mom, and this boy grew up in a very matriarchal environment. It's growing up in a matriarchal environment. It's like he was only, like, the father was out of the picture, so he's only really spent time around women. And it's a 2-year-old boy, or maybe even it was 1.5, because he wasn't speaking yet. I remember my friend invited me to a party, and like a get together. It was like her cousins, all women, right? I was the only guy. I show up like halfway through. And the little boy, who's maybe 1.5, is just like dancing around, being cute, getting all this like oohs and ahs and cuteness and all this validation. Even though he can't even speak, he's getting all this validation from these women, right? Instinctually, he knew that like he was just loved, and he was comfortable, and he was just being cute in the way that children know how to be cute. And I walk in, and I wasn't saying anything, and he's just dancing around, and he's laughing, and he's playing, and everyone's like, you know, going on, whatever. And then he turns around, he sees me, and immediately goes like this, right? This is a little kid. Like, he doesn't know anything. I mean, all he could tell on some level that was I was different than everyone else. Like, I was a male human, right? And immediately, he straightened up, and he sat down, and he just sat. And he was nervous, and I didn't mean to make him nervous, right? But it shows you, like, even like down to like a child level, like a pre-toddler even, there's something where he knew that he was not going to get the same type of giggly, googly, nonstop validation from me, right? At one look, at one glance, he could sense it, right? Not because I'm a mean person. I mean, I love kids, but like, you don't get this automatic validation from men. And this is an important part, because I mean, I don't know the kid, right? I don't know how he grows up, but someone who only grows up around women, who's used to getting that nonstop validation, and this is like, you know, one of the roots of the mother complex, will not feel secure around men, because he knows that men are going to challenge him. Men aren't going to give him validation just because he's the opposite sex. There's something like, and I think this ties into participation trophy culture, where, you know, if you grew up getting validation from not accomplishing stuff or not winning, it leaves this void in your heart, right? Even if it feels good to get a fake trophy, it's like, it leaves this void where, like, you're not sure if when the shit really hits the fan, can you really handle stuff? Because I didn't really earn that trophy. Like, I didn't really earn the validation. You know, I mean, I got the validation from women, whether it's my mother or whomever, just for being me, which is nice. You know, it's nice to like know that you're worth something just for being you. We'll talk about that in the lover archetype, and we spoke about the anima next week. But there has to be some, like, there's certain virtues that you can only trust in yourself if you actually earn them. This is why competition is so critical, and putting yourself into hard things are so critical. So men naturally act differently around men, because we interact differently. Like, we are the same, as opposed to there's certain things in women that you can appreciate just because they're women. There's something that's not natural to you. So one thing in how men interact and how men bond is, like, we give each other checks naturally. Women offer friendship or offer connection
by immediately validating each other, right? Like if you see two women and they want to be friends, what do they say? Like, oh, I love your shirt. Like, where'd you get it? Blah, blah, blah. Like that's like the subcommunication of, I think you're great. I want to be friends. I'm not a threat to you. I'm not going to try to steal your man. I'm not going to try to undermine you or kick you out or ostracize you from the social hierarchy. Like that's when a woman says, oh, I love your blah, blah, blah. I love your hair. That's her way of saying it, right? That's why it's so critical when women meet each other. If they actually want to be friends, they say that. If they don't say something like that, they have to close up. They have to guard themselves. This guy going to steal my boyfriend, blah, blah, blah. Men are a little different, right? Men show these signs of respect by validating each other's strength. So on the surface level, it might be like some sort of like interest, right? You show interest in a person. I mean, this is true for you know, any sort of gender. But there's something that is to really show respect to each other, you give some sort of challenge or check, and is often in the form of humor. But I want to, before we get into the virtues and stuff, so one thing with millennial guys that Dr. Robert Glover mentioned when he was on the show a few months ago, or I guess it was over a year ago, is that a lot of people rag on millennial men and you know, this the millennials and younger, right? Like, and women even say this, right? Like younger guys have lost certain bits of their edge, right? This is we are the least masculine generation ever, at least before, you know, as far as this era, or I mean, certainly probably throughout history. But Dr. Glover did mention that we are the most empathic, right? Millennial guys and younger seem to be the most emotionally aware. They seem to dress better than previous generations. Like they're in touch with their feminine side. They're in touch with oxytocin. Maybe we've grown up with more oxytocin receptors because of cat photos on Instagram and more likely feminism and how culture has shifted to reward more feminine virtues, which is why young guys are more emotionally aware. I hear this a lot from my female friends who are like in their 30s or early 40s who've dated both generations. They're like, millennial guys and younger will say, can I kiss you? And it's so gross. I've heard this, like I have a friend who's 40 who's dated younger and older, and she's like, she can't believe that someone would ask, can I kiss you? Whereas if you've grown up during the Me Too movement, that's actually not a bad move, right? Like for a 20-year-old guy or a 20-year-old woman, that might be almost expected. I mean, I don't know. I'm in between these ages. But there has been a shift. And I think, you know, with consumerist infantilization of people, this whole idea of like being expecting validation or softness or like being super emotionally aware is not necessary. I mean, the empathy part is not bad, but this over infantilization certainly is not healthy. So one way that people, and the reason why this is missing, and you can look at fatherless homes or shaming of masculine all-male environments, like, you know, everyone wants to make fun of fraternities and like these kinds of groups, but they are critical for developing male self-esteem. When we talk about male bonding, one of like the highest levels, like the opposite of hey, I love your sweater between women, is making fun of each other, right? And you can see this throughout various ways. Like guys, when they're close, they make fun of each other. You can see this in Gran Torino, the Clint Eastwood movie. Like Clint Eastwood takes the young Hmong kid under his wing. He's trying to show him how to be a man, and he shows him how him and his buddies like make fun of each other. And it's funny, if you haven't seen the movie, it's a great movie. But so he's trying to teach the young kid of how to make fun of other guys, because that's how men bond. So the kid comes in and says something like really derogatory to Clint Eastwood's friend, and then they were just like, well, you can't say that. Which, I mean, it's humorous, but it shows that, because what it is when two guys make fun of each other, it's kind of like puppies play fighting. If you've ever seen two puppies playing, what they're really doing is pretending to kill each other, right? Like they might be wagging their tails and jumping on each other, but what are they doing? They're trying to put their neck, their mouth on each other's neck. Like they are practicing. Play is a practice for competitive life skills, right? Any kind of play. Like if you look at sports, all of these things like develop both the mental skills and the physical skills to conquer an opponent. When two guys make fun of each other, it's a sign of male bonding, because essentially what you're doing is, one, you're demonstrating courage, that like I'm willing to like dig into you, right? Like I'm not afraid of you. I'm showing that I'm willing. And then when the person accepts it, when the person laughs and then sends it back, it's almost like it's like bending the knee. It's like it's showing mutual submission, which is critical when we talk about two people. If you look at like where all of our testosterone driven virtues come from, or their functions in violence or strength or whatever, when two guys can make fun of each other and they both can laugh, they're basically mutually submitting and saying, I'm willing to suffer for you, right? Like, obviously a joke at your expense isn't really suffering, but there is like an ego check, right? When a guy makes a joke about someone else, he's like reminding him, hey, you're not high and mighty. Like, I'm not putting you ahead of me. You better not put yourself ahead, because if you don't take this joke well, it shows that you think you're better than us, and that's not cool, right? There's like a, it's like a, it's a, whereas like maybe the feminine bonding is like about boosting each other up, but masculine bonding is about making sure we stay at the same level, or like not going high and mighty, which maybe seems like a negative thing. I think a lot of people see this as toxic masculinity, but this is critical, right? Like, if you don't have those checks, you don't know where your ceiling is. You don't have an opportunity to prove yourself, and you have all this like bolstered up fake self-esteem that you see a lot since the participation trophy culture became a thing. But it's also, it goes down to a critical piece of like actual development of character. And the reason why, you know, all certain virtues are considered masculine is that when someone makes fun of you and you make fun of them and you both can laugh at it, you're saying, I'm willing to suffer for you, which is, when we go back to those rites of passage of like, it's not enough to just show a boy that he's strong, it's to show him that he needs to use his strength for the benefit of other people. When you're willing to laugh at each other, you're basically saying, I'm willing to do hard things on your behalf too, right? It's showing that you're not just using your potency for yourself. And this is where like all of male man-to-man respect comes from, is, can I trust you to hold down the fort for us, right? I do love Jack Donovan's concept, or at least what he talks about in his book, Way of Men, about all of male virtues are there to protect the perimeter. Like, we think of our pre-agricultural ancestors, you know, women obviously get pregnant, not saying that they have to or whatever. I mean, obviously a lot has changed in modern society, but back then, you know, our functions in a tribe largely came down to our biology. Women back then, there's no contraceptives, so they were probably pregnant half the time or with small children, breastfeeding a lot of time. So what do the men do? Like, the men, we've evolved to be sexually dimorphic because men don't get pregnant. They might as well have more muscle and protect the perimeter, right? When the women and children are vulnerable, someone has to protect the perimeter of, you know, from invaders, from predators, from the weather, blah, blah, blah. So all things that men inherently, instinctively respecting each other come down to, can I trust you to protect the perimeter? And you know, being able to laugh at each other is one of these things. Kind of just like a random tangent, I'm reading this book that I'm eventually going to do a podcast episode on called Liber Null. It's a Western occult book. I'm actually trying to get the author, Peter Carroll, on the podcast. He's the first proponent of what is known as chaos magic. Very different topic, but in the book he speaks about certain principles that tie in a lot to like the Jungian psychology stuff that we often speak about. But he was speaking about like different emotions and their functions, and how pretty much every emotion has an opposite, like fear and desire, love and hate. Laughter is the only emotion that is its own opposite. Like, laughter is the highest experience of emotion, because it's like there's nothing. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. Like, laughter is its own opposite. It's the highest emotion of like actually seeing the entire field and accepting and approving of it and getting off on it, to use other language. All right, so the three virtues I want to speak about is our when it comes to male respect, our strength or competency, courage, and honor. Speaking about courage first, I have this out of order on my page, but courage is the willingness to enter tension, period, right? Like, we spoke about that a lot in the warrior archetype. Like, one way to activate that in yourself is to initiate tension, right? It's not enough to just show up to the battlefield and wait for the enemy to come to you. It's like, can you enter that? And this shows up a lot in life, like whether it's saying the hard thing, confronting the person you have a hard time with, or telling the woman that you're into her, like all of these initiations, or like I use the sexual example, right? Like, a lot of guys, if they're passive in sexuality or hesitant, it actually depresses their neuroendocrine system. Like, they actually, what would become testosterone might actually turn into cortisol, and they become more and more stressed, and then they have an issue getting it up later because they've actually, through the behavior of not initiating, they've allowed their nervous system to depress and go into prey mode. I spoke about that extensively last week, but this courage matters between men, because the first thing is willingness, right? Like, if there's a zombie apocalypse, if there's if barbarians come over the hill, if it starts snowing and we have to build something to keep our children from freezing to death or go hunting, like, can I count on you to throw the spear or swing the hammer when the time comes? Which is why when guys shy away from tension, and this can be seen in like the simple experience of guys making fun of each other, if you shy away from it, if you get butt hurt because someone teased you about something you did, it shows like, okay, I can't respect you, or I can't, you know, I can't trust you to hold things down, because even from a little bit of discomfort, you fall away. That's where courage, that's why courage matters so much, and why, especially between men, you inherently lose respect for someone who shies away from hard things or things that are uncomfortable, right? And we have so much respect for people. Because, like, if you look at the movie, I mentioned this last week, but if you look at the movies that typically make guys cry, I don't know if Rudy is a popular movie anymore. I mean, I know it came out like over 20 years ago, but, you know, Rudy or like any of these, or there are 300, like movies where guys try and fail. It's not even about the winning, right? 300, obviously, they all die, right? They die for a cause. And Rudy, the kid wants to be a linebacker for Notre Dame. He never really makes the team, but he gets that one sack at the end. Like, it makes everyone, I mean, it makes guys ball. Why? Because you can see, like, he suffered, but he was still brave enough to keep doing the thing. And that, and, you know, and we inherently have respect for people like that. The next piece, it's not just enough to have the willingness. It's like, can you actually do it, right? Like, it's great if someone's willing to pick up an axe and run into battle, but if he's too weak to even lift it, well, that's also useless. So inherently we all, I mean, this goes across the board, men, women, whatever, we respect competency. I mean, specifically in men, right? It's one of the more attractive traits. This is why Omer Pani spoke about this when he was on the podcast at one of his appearances. Like, before dating skills were discussed, before like leadership became like this complex thing, like in the early 1900s, leadership training was synonymous with public speaking training. Like, or even back in like ancient Greece or even in many other societies, oratory was one of the things that was respected as like one of the primary masculine skills. Why? Because it showed competency, right? If you were eloquent enough to string words together and make arguments, people could trust you to lead a group in battle or to organize the field, right? Because being able to protect and provide doesn't just come down to whether or not you're strong enough to swing a weapon. It's actually, when it comes to humans, a greater skill is, can you organize a bunch of people to swing their weapons together? Like, that's actually a more useful skill. And that's why on sports teams, the best athlete is always the captain, which is something I've always wondered about, because like when it comes to like, it's like, you know, any sports team, just being good at the sport doesn't mean you're the best leader, right? Like, some people are terrible at giving instruction. In fact, very often the naturally gifted athlete is terrible at guiding other people because like he naturally is good. Like, how can he teach the other kid? But we still need the leader to be really good at the sport, because how can we trust him? Like, he can say all these perfect things, but like if he can't do it himself, I mean, sometimes just being able to sink the shot yourself is enough of inspiration to everyone else. And then finally, the third virtue is honor, right? This idea of honor, and I was tempted to go say honor, courage, commitment, as is the Marine Corps motto. I mean, we're keeping it at courage, strength, or competency, and honor. Honor is such a critical virtue for men, because when it comes to potency, right, going back to this rite of passage idea of like, all of these young men now have testosterone surging through them. They have the potency to create or destroy. Honor is where guys can trust, okay, when my back is turned, are you actually going to be with the tribe, right? When my back is turned, can I trust you to not sleep with my wife, or you know, not abduct or like steal my crops or steal my sheep? Like, this idea of honor is so critical. Honor on many levels. Like, can I, honor essentially is like, a person is honorable if we can trust them to do what they say they're going to do. Whether it's like actually do the hard things, like, you know, I mean, a lot of times when we speak of honor culture sociologically, very often we're talking about like, will a guy back defend his name? And I won't go too deep into this, but you know, it's it was featured in Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink, where they're speaking about how in the American South there's this deep honor culture, right? Like, in the American South, traditionally, if a man insulted your wife and you shot him, you would not be convicted, right? Because in the American South, which was, according to most theories, the reason why there's honor culture in the American South, partly because of the Wild West, because without the law to uphold justice for you, you needed to uphold your own justice. But a lot of the roots are from the people who settled, the Americans, eventual Americans who settled the American South. came from Northern Europe in the Highlands, where everyone was where most people's sustenance came from raising cattle or raising animals. And animals are really easy to steal. Like wheat, like, it's very hard to steal someone's entire wheat crops, but it's very easy to steal someone's horses or steal someone's sheep or steal someone's lamb. And if someone did that and you didn't go after them and kill them, then everyone would know, oh, we can steal the rest of his lamb. Like, you needed to have a reputation of violence for anyone to respect you, for people to not steal from you, and for your family to live on, which is why honor culture, or honor became such a, honor in the defending your name sense, became, naturally evolved into becoming a dominant strategy sociologically. But there's also honor in just keeping your word. Back to like, pre-agriculture again, tribal leadership, before civilization was able to evolve in a way that they were able to have standing armies and kings were able to have people do violence on their behalf to keep everyone in line, before tyranny was possible. Back in like these small groups of like 50 to 100 people, tyranny wasn't really possible. Like in those situations, and I think this is why, you know, right-wing politics kind of glorifies this, because they kind of go back to small unit leadership. They go, most right-wing everything believes in like independent governance as opposed to centralized governance. The reason is because in these small tribes, naturally the government was afraid of the people, right? Like, it wasn't like a thing that you had to uphold with the Second Amendment. Like, that was like, you know, if there's only 25 guys in a small tribe, the biggest and baddest might rise to leadership, but if he's an asshole to everyone, if people can't trust him, if like he always goes back on his word, if he never follows through, if he's selfish, if he does anything that isn't doesn't give him a sense of honor, everyone else is just going to gang up on him and take you know, and kill him, right? Like, in a small group, naturally the leader is afraid of the people, in the sense of like the leader has to uphold certain values, which is why, I mean, and back then, like, you know, the leader would be expected to mediate conflict, right? Between two guys, there's a dispute over food, over something. They would go to the leader, who would mediate. If they didn't trust that he keeps his word, if they didn't trust that he was honorable, one or both parties wouldn't want to go to him. So like for anyone to be king in or chief in a small tribe, he had to have the respect of everyone, both with his courage, his willingness to do hard things, his strength or competency, his ability to do hard things, but also, was he honorable enough that we can trust his judgment, right? Because if they can't trust his judgment in a small group, there's no army, right? Everyone is the army. So they would just be like, no, I'm not going to do that. There's no police force. Everyone is the police force. It was like, well, if I don't trust you, if I don't trust your code, I'm just not going to follow you. And then society breaks down, which is why these ideas of chivalry were so critical pre-agriculturally. And even though in modern society we have a standing police force, none of us are directly in contact with our leader. Like, no Americans, very few American citizens actually communicate with the president or president-elect. Like, there's this anonymity which allows for tyranny and allows for oppression, because we're not, our brains aren't meant to organize in these groups this big. Our emotions still fall on this. So, like, I spoke about this last week. A lot of things that a lot of masculine or testosterone-driven virtues that we've evolved to have, honestly, are somewhat obsolete in the first world, 21st century life, right? Unless you're in the armed forces, unless you're in the police force, unless you're in a gang where you're actually fighting over territory, whether that's the right thing to do or not, like, unless you're in a situation like that, you don't really need to demonstrate strength, courage, and honor on a regular basis. But our emotions still run on these, you can call them outdated or, obsolete circuits, if you will, but our emotions still run on that, right? This is why these kinds of things still get us emotional when we watch movies. These are why this is what causes respect between people, whether or not they're necessary traits. Anyway, I want to say one thing. I forgot to make this note. Not saying this is the right thing, but I don't know if it's true anymore with modern culture, but when I was a kid, you know, 20 years ago, between boys, the accusation of being gay was like the worst thing, right? Like, a lot of boys, I mean, don't even, or when they first learn, or even before they know what the word means, right? They throw this word around. And I'm not saying that's a good thing. Certainly want to accept people of all orientations and whatnot. But the reason why this is chosen as an insult instinctively for many boys is that it has nothing to do with homosexuality. And in my opinion, it's just like, there's this concept, this instinctive concept of these virtues, these masculine virtues of strength, courage, and honor. And like something about like throwing someone into a category of non-man, which I think is what little like boys who are trying to just insult each other do, you know, not really thinking about it, obviously lacking compassion in many ways, but they're just throwing this out because like that kind of accusation is one of, it's like the worst challenge on an instinctive level. Jack Donovan speaks about this in his book. Jack Donovan's actually a homosexual guy. He doesn't use the word gay because he feels that, as far as I understand from his writing, gay culture kind of overrid homosexual culture. Like not every homosexual is part of gay culture. I'm going to let him speak about it when he's on the podcast, but I didn't really think about that. I never thought about it before, being a straight guy. But then I thought like, oh yeah, like there are certain memes that everyone assumes is part of homosexual culture. I don't mean to comment on this necessarily, but like the whole idea behind like the limp-wristedness, like when someone speaks in a certain voice that we consider to be a gay voice or shows limp-wristedness, they are self-identifying in a way. Like I've asked gay friends, like, what is the deal with like gay flamboyancy? Like, why is this like kind of a thing that so many guys who sleep with guys have? Like, this mode of behavior seems like such a specific way of being. And gay guys I know, gay friends have said like, oh, well, it is a way of like identifying each other. And like most guys turn up the flamboyancy when they're in a game bar or like a gay gym or something. But then I read Jack Donovan's interpretation, which I understood of like specifically like, let's say limp-wristedness. Like what is the deal with like making your wrist like this that kind of shows that you behave a certain way, you have certain sexual proclivities. And my understanding of what Jack Donovan was saying is like, well, think about it. Like if you're showing a limp wrist, you're kind of demonstrating that you're not good at swinging a sword, right? So you're kind of letting everyone know like that's not the role I'm going to play in our tribe. Right. Whether, you know, whatever your opinions are on it, like, you know, I want people to be however they are. But as far as like the roles, the necessary roles, I don't mean like culturally imposed roles, but like the actual functions that testosterone driven behavior leads to for the tribe virtue, it usually has to do with swinging tools and like doing hard things with other opposing forces. If you are demonstrating that you're not good at holding tools, you're letting everyone know like, hey, I might look like a guy, but this is not the function I'm choosing to play in society. I have a different function. Like that's my understanding of it now. I'm curious to speak about it with Jack himself. So anyway, I want to end with my take on men's groups. Is there anything else I want to? Oh, I want to say one more thing on ethos. So as you maybe know, like there's the three categories of, we spoke about oratory a second ago, the three categories of making an argument, of convincing someone as theorized by ancient Greek orators. There's logos, pathos, and ethos. Logos being the logical argument. A great example of that is Jordan Peterson. He's very logos. Or many, many conservative thinkers like Ben Shapiro, if you look at their mic drops on YouTube, it's all like logos. Like they're basically making their opponents look foolish by using really well-crafted logical arguments. There's pathos people, pathos being emotion, as in like empathy. A great male example of masculine pathos would be someone like David Goggins. Like he gets people fired up, right? He's not making this like a very thoughtful, logical argument. He's just like, this is what you do, like this, whatever, right? He gets people stirred up. Like the football coach who gives the really good speech that gets everyone like riled up, that's a pathos argument. But then ethos is character. And ethos, character is like kind of the hardest thing to pin down because it's not, character isn't something you do. In one action, like you don't do character, like you don't, in the way you make a logical argument or you make an emotional appeal. Character is like who you are. And I heard this theory, actually I'm going to say that for another time, but I'm a huge Joe Rogan fan. And there's a lot of, and many people are, like he's the most popular podcaster ever. And I've seen a lot of people who maybe don't totally get Joe Rogan or look at him like, why is he so popular? He seems like a regular guy, or he seems like, you know, he doesn't have like the super deep questions that Tim Ferriss has. He's not a professional journalist. Yeah, he's entertaining, but it's not like he's making jokes nonstop or like running sets on his podcast. Like, what is it about Joe Rogan that makes him so appealing for so many people to listen to him? And I've seen like analyses on YouTube of like, oh, he does this and he does that. He's using this technique. And I don't think any of those are true. The reason why Joe Rogan is so popular and why his interviews are so different than every other person, like if you listen to any of his interviews with like famous people who are also on many other shows, their interviews on Joe Rogan are different. Like they're particularly vulnerable. They're particularly real. And the reason is Joe Rogan's one of the few interviewers that all of his guests respect back. right? Like a lot of times, like some like there's he has really interesting guests, obviously, who are many on many other shows, but they're looking up to him. So they open up in a way to him that they don't open up to you know, a news journalist, because they respect his ethos so deeply because of who he is, of what he does in his life, that have nothing to do with the interview. Like he can just be talking or he can just be listening, but because who he is, his ethos of like the things is like the things he actually stands by, the things he does with his life, that gets so much respect from other people. I mean, the fact that he's famous is part of it, but there's many famous, like, you know, people don't speak the same way to Larry King. Larry King is also famous. And Larry King is also an extremely skilled, you know, journalist who asks deep questions, or Charlie Rose. Like, people don't speak to Charlie Rose the way they speak to Joe Rogan, because Joe Rogan isn't an interviewer when you sit across from Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan is someone that they look up to. You even see MMA fighters all look up to Joe Rogan. So they open up in a way that they don't open up to anyone else, because they fully respect him, and like that is ethos. All right, so I'm gonna close with men's groups, because you know, especially with the COVID lockdown world we're in, a lot of people are starving for social interaction, are recognizing that they want real deep social interaction. And when it comes to these tribal virtues of steel sharpening steel, and like accessing certain elements of yourself that you don't get to access otherwise, men's groups are a great way to do this. Because, you know, in travel society, in modern larger than Dunbar's number organizations of people, men's groups don't naturally form, right? Unless you're on a sports team, which is one of the traditional ways people bond, or military or fraternity, any of these things that are kind of more, I mean, men's groups are one of the more necessary things, because, I mean, it's true that men's groups are necessary because of the fact that society has become so unmasculine. So they are kind of an artificial way of reconnecting to instinctual things, in the same way of like, I've been following a lot of sleep hacking stuff. I'm going to have a sleep hacker on the show in next month. And a lot of the sleep tips she offers are basically, how can you behave the way our Paleolithic ancestors did, which is like the Paleo diet, a lot of things. Like we've evolved for a certain lifestyle, and anything different than that kind of like messes with our emotions or our sleep or our ability to be healthy. And men's groups are one of these things, because naturally back when we actually had to hunt, the men's group was when guys were out on a hunt and they, you know, the sun went down and they sat around the campfire, that was a men's group. That's where they traded stories and were vulnerable and made jokes about each other. And like, that was a natural part of male life, or like, you know, a war party or anything, any of these things, or like a group of guys building teepees or wigwams, like that naturally happened. And that's kind of missing in today's society for most guys, in the same way that video games are the closest thing to adventure for accessible to most young men. You know, shit talking to each other while you play. I don't know. I don't even know what games are popular these days. You know, on the internet, that's like sometimes the closest thing to connection. But men's groups are a more focused version of that, an opportunity for masculine vulnerability. Because as we mentioned, the difference between the self-help brand of vulnerability, everyone says like, oh, be soft. That's important, right? We're gonna talk about the softer side, the oxytocin side next week. But like, there's an aspect of male bonding that can only happen through challenge and ragging on each other and like doing hard things and doing an activity together. I'll say like, this is the first time in my life, especially since I was in a cult, where I really have found a community that I love. And part of that is that I'm around a bunch of guys who I really like and respect. And you know, we don't call them men's groups, but like we've gone on trips together, and you can really shoot the shit, because when there are no women around, kind of like with the example I opened this episode with the 2-year-old kid who straightened up and sat down when he saw me, guys act differently around guys. When there's a woman around, even if there's one woman, all the attention kind of goes there and all behavior kind of modifies. It's not that every guy wants to get with a girl, that can happen. It's like, every guy wants to be seen a certain way by the girl. So like, certain jokes are omitted, certain behaviors are lost. Like, guys are not so mean to each other. And I mean mean not necessarily in a bad way, because like, that edge is kind of necessary for real vulnerability between men. When there's an all-male environment, you actually get to, I mean, I was going to say let your hair down, which is probably the opposite analogy. But you get to actually express certain things that you wouldn't express in a mixed group. So other reasons, and the reason why I posted this thing last year about how to start men's groups, why to start men's groups, are one is opportunity. I mean, specifically starting your own men's group. I mean, you might be able to find one, or maybe your social circle of guys already is exactly this. But sometimes it's hard to find, especially in this world where we get to choose. We have unlimited choice of where to socialize and how to meet people. Starting your own thing makes it be like, okay, this is the thing I want to experience. guys who also want to experience that can meet me. So like I just had one of my clients, he's into adventure stuff. He's into stoicism. He created a meetup group called the Stoic, I think it's called the Stoics Action Club or something like that. Just a way to attract guys that want to talk about the stuff that he wants to talk about, who want to do the cold plunges or nature walks that he wants to talk about. It's the most recent, but I've had a lot of clients and students start their own men's groups and find like-minded guys if they describe it the right way. So it's also an opportunity, especially if you are trying to access your own ability to be a leader. This is more of the king archetype stuff. Simply, I mean, I quote Omar Pani on this a lot of times, responsibility creates power. Like people always say the quote backwards, like with great power comes great responsibility. But if you actually take more responsibility, especially for other people, it gives you a sense of power when people defer to you. Because when we talk about dominance and submission on a regular social level, on a cooperative social level, where you're not like domineering people, but like the dominant person in a group is the person that other people trust to make decisions for them, right? Like if you're going on a group with a bunch of your buddies and you're the one booking the hotel or the logistics and people are like, yeah, I trust you to book the logistics, they've best essentially in that moment submitted to you in a cooperative way, right? And it gives you a sense of power that bolsters self-esteem, like the real kind of self-esteem, not just the padded participation trophy. And because like on a tribal level, real leadership is service, right? In our giant tribe worlds, leadership can turn into tyranny because of all the artificial forces that I mentioned earlier. And also, I will say, like a lot of guys who want to become coaches reach out to me. Starting a men's group is the absolute best way because you don't have to charge money. It's an opportunity that you get to be around a lot of guys. You get a lot of experience hearing real vulnerable stories. And I personally developed my competence as a coach running men's groups, right? I was just a facilitator. I'm gonna speak about my breakdown of men's groups in a second, but like I developed my competence and confidence running men's groups because one, I learned how to like sit in tension with a lot of people, a lot of men. I got to hear a lot of stories. So I got to like understand the male psyche more, not just my own brain. I also recognize things about myself, but also just facilitating a group of a bunch of guys talking, even if I'm not necessarily coaching anyone or guiding people, just that gave me a sense of confidence of like, oh, I know how to guide people's minds. And when you do that with like 10 or 12 people all at once, even if it's not particularly deep into every individual person, just being able to follow the thread of thought is so critical. I mean, that in itself is a masculine virtue. So I'm going to end with the last couple minutes here of how I run my own men's groups, because I'm not going to go on a whole rant on this, but a lot of things I've seen, especially in like the hippie side of personal development, they're so effeminate. And you have like they're so-called men's groups run by a super effeminate guy. And I have nothing against like guys who want to express themselves in a feminine way. I think that's great at times. But if you're running a group that advertises itself for helping people get into their masculine and you're not upholding masculine virtues, you're not being grounded, you're not like holding people accountable to things, you're only perpetuating the atrophy of masculinity, and it makes me real mad. Like I hate like these talking circles. Like that's great for women's groups. Like women need that where they just share and listen, but like men need something a little stronger. Anyway, this is my own personal opinion on how men's groups should be run. The way I always started is I advertise what the thing is so it attracts the right kind of guys, not guys who just want a circle jerk. I always give an intro of the structure, making it very clear what the things are, and I'm pretty strict on time. For every section, there's like a hard start and stop time. If someone's in the middle of a thought, I might give them a pass. You don't have to be an asshole if someone's really opening up. But it's also a skill for every guy in the group to learn how to make their thoughts concise enough and express themselves directly as opposed to just blabbing out. So give a clear structure of the time. And then we start with shares, which simply is every guy sharing what they want to talk about, what's going on for them. They might have a minute, they might have a minute and a half, they might have 2 minutes, but I actually hold the time and I show the time so like every guy can keep themselves accountable of not just blabbing out into the universe and getting super watery, but being precise of like, this is the thing that's going on for me. And when a guy goes to their first men's group, they might be bad at talking about themselves. They might have nothing to say, or they might talk about a bunch of things that aren't really the thing. But every time, if you hold them accountable to that, it gives them an opportunity to practice being precise, which is a skill in itself. For a guy who's like very scatterbrained, that's probably the thing he needs more than anything else. You're doing them a service, even if you cut them off at a certain time. And you enter open discussion. Even in open discussion, as the facilitator, I'm not choosing what we talk about, but through the shares, I try to pick out the common threads. Because if you have 10 guys in a group and you're only going to speak for 45 minutes or even an hour and a half, which is like the longest I would let open discussion go, you can't talk about everyone's individual story. And not everyone wants to talk about their individual story. But it will become obvious in a group of 10 or whatever guys, certain guys have something potent, or like a bunch of people have common threads. So after a bunch of share, after everyone shares, including myself, I feel the facilitator's role is to call out the common threads. It's like, okay, we got people talking about women. We got people talking about purpose. I mean, these are the super general things. You might see more specific things, like there's something going on with like competitiveness or jealousy, or maybe two guys in the group have a conflict and that is something that could be talked about. Like all of these are opportunities for realness. And like anything, any opportunity, like if I were to look at, because when we talk about the lover archetype and connecting to the feminine, I would say all of that world is an opportunity, whether it's approaching a woman or anything, or your own feminine side, it's an opportunity for vulnerability, which is important. When it comes to the male-male connection, it's an opportunity to handle tension, which is its own kind of vulnerability. Like the most vulnerable thing I think that two men can do is have a real fight where they're recognizing each other, right? In that conflict, you get to really see, because there's so much vulnerability in competition. So any opportunity, so when we look at all the threads, the potential discussion topics to start with, you could call it following the sensation. I'm looking for where is the opportunity for us to ground the most tension, right? It's not about intellectualizing theories. I mean, I always invite guys to ask for advice if they want it, but like when we float up into the abstract, that almost never is useful as far as the group. Because we all can go on forums and look up ideas and field advice there, or like theorize about stuff over there. The thing that makes men's groups most effective is like we can talk about real stuff. The content might be super important, but it's the opportunity to ground tension with other people, because that was what really develops the sense of connection and male bonding that bolsters our self-esteem. That when we leave the men's group and go out into the world, whether it's with our girlfriends or at work, or chasing, you know, the business opportunity or the other hard thing, that's what actually gives us the backbone to recognize like, oh, I have all this practice grounding tension with guys I respect. I can handle a lot of other things. And like, that's the point of the campfire discussion. So open discussion. I do invite people to ask for advice. And sometimes you got to zero in on a person who like really needs help or really needs something to express, because very often, unless it's a super obscure topic, a bunch of guys offering their thoughts or advice or whatever thing to help one person very often helps everyone else. In a small group, if it's five people or less, we might focus on each person individually, but more than six or seven, you kind of have to leave things general. Or not general, but rather focus on a few core threads that apply to a lot of people. Because very often, if someone's discussing about a topic that's relevant to you, just whatever movement or unpacking that guy experiences can also work for everyone else, right? That's part of the classroom effect. But I always end with future commitments, because testosterone thrives on commitment and accomplishment. So at the end of every group, whether it's a weekly group or a monthly group or even a group, I haven't had a regular men's group in a long time, but even with my buddies, when we go away, like we set some sort of commitment, that kind of commitment is effective, right? You keep each other accountable, it's not just about the accountability. It's about like the opportunity to keep your word with an audience of people you respect. When I see these men's groups that meet every week and they talk about their goals or intentions, but they never actually do it, I'm just like, it's not just that you're missing out on opportunity. You're actually making things worse. You're actually making everyone a little bit less good at being a man by making these so-called intentions and then not actually following through. You're kind of wasting the whole point of meeting up for an hour or 2 hours if you don't actually hold to the commitments or even keep or mention the commitments. And then finally, I end with something. I mean, it's not the best title for something, but it's called Intimacies. I actually learned this at the cults. I think it's a very effective communication tool where after everyone makes their commitments, every guy has one last opportunity to say a direct communication to another guy in the group. And this is an opportunity for real vulnerability, because like a really real vulnerability, because we had the shares, we had the open discussion, which maybe was intellectual, maybe it wasn't, whatever, but we've gotten to know each other a little bit, right? Whether it's a regular meeting group or just this one time. And the intimacy section is an opportunity where each guy gets to say something about what they really feel about someone else. And it might be airing a judgment that they had. It's like, oh yeah, I thought you were a huge dick until you shared that thing and I realized like you actually remind me of something that I want to access in myself, so I was a little jealous. Like these kind of things, right? It could be a compliment. It could be like, I think you're a fucking piece of shit. All of these opportunities, again, if you think of like the goal of the men's group in every moment, and I think it's important as a facilitator, is to seek real tension in order to ground it. Not tension for the sake of stirring like stuff up for just the sake of it. I don't want people to get into fist fights. That's not necessarily useful. But to have an opportunity to ground tension, that is real masculine vulnerability. And yeah, these intimacies are an opportunity because if you guys have spoken for an hour plus, you can say stuff that is really real and potent to each other, that whether it's hard, whether it's positive or negative, if it's real, it is useful and it will create respect between people, even if you're saying the hard truth between people. Assuming that everyone has upheld the virtue of honor where like, you can actually trust each other to handle shit or to take the truth or be open to discussing stuff and have a real reaction. I think it's very freeing. And then you close and then do whatever you do afterwards. So these are all my thoughts on that. And with last announcements, on Thursday, we had the BJJ Globetrotter, Christian Graugott, on the podcast. We had a great discussion on the us versus them paradigm. And jiu-jitsu and travel. He's a very interesting dude. Hopefully we'll have Jack Donovan on soon and just got in touch with him, speaking more about topics related to this. He wrote the book The Way of Men. I think he's a very interesting guy. And then other things are coming up that I can't announce, so I'm not going to announce them. All right, thanks for listening. Peace.